Talk number 5, which is the second discussion by Vimala Thakkar on the 15th of August 1974 at Ljusbacken, Delsbo. Om det är möjligt att hälsa någon välkommen till Norge.
Could we perhaps return the ball to your side of the court today?
Pardon?
I said, could we perhaps return the ball to your side of the court today?
Sure. Mm. The ball you can turn to your court today.
Why? No discussion?
That was just my idea.
I have one question. Which is the difference in the effect of you answered my question yesterday about mantra meditation, and now I want to continue the question with asking what is the difference between being aware of a mantra or being when you are aware of your breath? Which will there be any difference in the effect of such a concentration?
Will there be any difference in the effect if a person concentrates upon the breath and is aware of the breath, and a person is aware of the mantra? Is that it? The breathing process is not something that you create or you invent. It is not your conscious activity. There is no effort in it. It is an effortless process with which you are born. You may learn a scientific approach to breathing, pranayama, deep breathing, proper way of inhaling, retaining the breath and exhaling it. You may sophisticate it, but the breathing process is something with which you are born. So you do not have to exercise the will or the effort. It is not something outside of you that you are trying to bring in. Secondly, the breathing has a sound but not a word. The inhaling of the breath, and while you retain the breath and the breath permeates in your whole being, flows through various nerves and muscles and ligaments, and glands. It has its own sound. While you inhale it, while you retain it, and while you exhale it, the breath passing through various parts of the body results in a sound, but it has no word. It is not something human. No languages can decipher that sound. It is a whole sound that flows through the veins. Because it has no meaning, it has no word, the concentration upon the breath does not stimulate any chemical reaction in you. When you concentrate upon a mantra, you have to make an effort to pronounce it correctly. It's like using a sword or a knife or a very sharp spear, because every pronunciation, intonation and accent resulting in the emanation of sound waves envelops you in a kind of energy. So when you pronounce the mantra, there is a conscious effort to pronounce it correctly. There is an effort to understand the meaning. There is an effort to apply the mantra in such a way that it leads to the calculated result. So the cerebral stimulation and the chemical stimulation is there when you concentrate upon a mantra. But if a person concentrates upon his breath, then it has no complications around it. So the chemical stimulation, provocation, or the cerebral provocation, the provocation of the past, the inheritance, the experience, is not there. It's a much simpler process. It is not something that you have to be given by someone else. It is free from the human language. It is free from psychological associations. Is that what you are asking? Was that the question? Or, yes?
But isn't following the breath somehow still a conscious movement? I mean, isn't there some effort involved? It seems to be a direction of attention, which does require...
When you focus your attention, when you concentrate upon it, then it is a conscious effort. He's asking me about the difference in the effect. If you concentrate upon a mantra and if you concentrate upon a breath, concentration by itself is an effort. Mm-hmm. Concentration has nothing to do with meditation. Mm-hmm. So even if he uses the word meditation with mantra, I am not connecting the two. Because I had explained very clearly yesterday the difference between the two. The mantras, the concentration of the breath, they have nothing whatsoever to do with meditation. It's a different direction of developing the mind, developing the mental powers, stimulating the experiences, visions, and so on. If you concentrate, it increases the mental power. Concentration stimulates many latent and potent mental powers. So those who want to develop the mind, they develop the mental powers, indulge in hidden mental experiences. For them, that the technique has been there since ancient days in many Eastern countries. But as I understand meditation, it's a different direction. When the mind moves not, the conscious, the unconscious, when there is no movement of the conditioned energy as well as the unconditioned energy, then only there is meditation. So, Concentration by itself requires an effort. I say I will concentrate upon the flame of the candle. I will concentrate upon the breath. I will concentrate upon something. So it is a mental activity in the field of duality. It is an activity in the field of the known.
Can I continue the question? Is there any...
Yes?
Is there any difference now in concentration on the breath as a whole, total, following the breath, or on the other hand, concentration on the sensation when the breath passes your nostrils?
Oh yes, there is a difference.
What is the difference?
But why are you asking these questions? What have they to do with the issues that I have discussed with you?
This is a...
The sensation is a momentary thing. Sensation is stimulated and subsides. But when you inhale the breath and you go in with the breath, the actual breath, which is a vital energy, and you watch its journey in your body. It's a process with which you go. And sensation is an occurrence. It happens in a fraction of a second and it's over. Then you may have another sensation and you look at that. So sensations are momentary, whereas breathing is a process in time and space. Yes?
All this came up because of a talk that you gave earlier where you suggested that if you're trying to educate yourself by observation and find it difficult, that one of the things you can do is to follow the breath as it goes in and out. No?
All right, if I have said it, because I can't remember my talks, so if I have said it, then you can go ahead. What was your question?
Well, the question is, can this help you towards observation?
You mean watching the breath?
Yes.
Watching the breath, because there is nothing to analyze and interpret, because it's not a complicated process, provoking the chemical system, the very watching of the breath, because while you are watching, you are not analyzing, interpreting, comparing or judging. So the watching becomes a state of sustained observation. You watch, you observe, you look at it. So watching of the breath, if somebody cannot watch thoughts, this might be I wonder if I have mentioned in these talks, but this could have been mentioned in the book Silence in Action.
It's in the book Meditation.
Yes, 1965. There was a camp of, I think, 25 psychologists with me, and we were discussing, and they said, what is self-education? If we can't watch the thought because the reaction comes up, is there any other way? Yes, you can take help of the breath, you see. So this is only to begin to learn how to observe. You are taking the help of the breathing process to learn to observe. So when you observe the breath, when you watch the breath, there are very few chances, if at all there are any, of a reaction coming up. It's only non-reactional attention then. So one gets equipped with sustaining the state of pure and simple attention.
You talk about learning to observe.
Yes.
Are you implying that it's a form of training?
Pardon?
Are you implying that it's a form of training? Or is it just in the language? Yeah.
Is there a difference between learning or training or not?
Well, you see, learning to observe seems to me to imply training. I'm asking you whether it's just in the structure of language that it's meant.
There is a great difference between education and training, learning and acquiring. When you train, then you must have a particular, a specific method or technique. In learning, you can find out your own aids and supports. You have to find out how you will learn. The question is to equip the brain with the state of observation, that's all. In training you would have been told you must observe this and you must not observe that. You must take help of one process only and not other. You must do it for 10 minutes or half an hour or 4 hours. You must do it for 6 months or 12 months. Training involves so many complications of an ideal, of a goal. Growth has no specific definition. When you learn to observe only, the brain is getting into a new dimension of consciousness. The consciousness has dimensions of experiencing, interpreting, analyzing. The consciousness hasn't developed this dimension of simple attention. So it is only a growth of the total psyche into the dimension of pure attention. And once you learn to observe, then you don't make a ritual that I know how to observe, I can observe, and yet I must sit down to look at my breath or look at my nose or look at the thought. You have grown into it, you live it, you move out of it. All the relationships there are in that dimension. Isn't there a difference between training and educating? You train a horse to run round and round in a ring for a circus. You train the monkeys to handle and drive the bicycles or cars or work with the typewriter. A human being learns. He grows. And what will be the expression of that growth in his relationship with others cannot be laid down as a scheme or a blueprint. The expression of that growth is unique to every individual. But in training, the result is the same. It is a standardized, organized, calculated result for which you train. No? No difference between training and educating or learning?
Yes.
No, she had raised her first.
I find it confusing to know exactly what to do in the periods of silence that we have, because I find myself thinking about daily activities, and then maybe the safest or the best direction for me to go in is to observe the breath or something. I'm not quite sure. What do you think is the best method?
How could I tell you the best? What is best for you? How could I tell you?
Could you tell me then what you do?
Nothing. Mm-hmm. You see, when you sit down, in silence, we sit down to be in the state of non-doing. Generally, we are in the field of activity, either we are active or inactive. We are acting or reacting. Now we have to educate ourselves. We don't know what silence is. So we say, well, let us be with ourselves. Let me be with myself. When I sit down or lie down or stand up, it's easy. The physical activities are winded up. They are gathered. The feet, the hands, the work. But then I notice that the ears do hear the sound. It is an involuntary activity of the ears. So they hear the sound. The eyes, when they are open, they see certain objects, colors, shapes, etc. And even if I close them, closing the eyes is not the silence of the sight. Even if you close the eyes, the sight is functioning. In the closed eyelids, the sight functions. It tries to see something. Doesn't matter if it is darkness. Doesn't matter if it is various shades of light or something. So first thing, when you sit down by yourself, you notice that the physical activities get gathered unto the ego, but the voluntary activities are no more there, but the involuntary activities are there. Like the blood circulation is there, the digestive process functions, the breathing process functions in the same way, the auditory, the optical, and the cerebral involuntary activities. You begin to notice the functioning of the involuntary activities. You notice them. It is not silence yet, but we are learning. We are trying to find out what silence is. So voluntary activities are no more there, but the involuntary are there. You don't resist the involuntary activity. If the ears hear the sound or the eyes see the objects, you don't prevent them. You don't try to close your eyes with great violence and force and keep them there. But you do not go with the object that the eye has seen. The eye, the me, the ego, does not go out to the object that the eye has seen and does not establish a relationship with it. Supposing a person has found out that the eyes and the ears, well, they withdraw from the objects. But the brain does not withdraw. The brain does not withdraw from thoughts, the involuntary activity of the brain. Because the object for the eyes was outside it. For the ears, the object is outside it. But the brain itself contains the thoughts. The brain contains the movement. We call it brain. We call it cerebral organ. But it is made of that matter. Brain is matter, you know. Thought is matter. What we call mind is matter. So, when you sit down, the brain moves. And the brain moves, you are concerned with the daily activities, so the thoughts of the day come in. Either the memory comes in, or what shall I do, what have I to do after the talk, is the cooking is not finished, and now will it be late for the luncheon? These thoughts come in. Let me not resist those thoughts, because I am here to be in the state of non-doing. If I do not resist the thought, if I resist the thought and I say, oh, I am sitting for silence and now these thoughts come in, then I am trying to act upon the movement. Already there is the movement and I will add another complication of resistance to it or an effort to suppress it. So let me not do anything at all with the thoughts, the feelings, the sentiments that come up. Just look at them. Look at them without reacting to them. And what happens is, when you look at them, you neither accept nor reject. You neither call them good or bad. You do not put them in any scale and measure them. Then the mind loses the fun in bringing them up to you. The mind has been pampered so much. As soon as it brings up a thought or emotion, I have been acting upon it or rejecting it. I have been either accepting it or rejecting. Now the mind unwinds, projects the thoughts, the feelings, and here I am not accepting, not rejecting, not suppressing, not denying, I am not doing anything to it. So when the momentum is neither resisted nor accepted, then that momentum becomes quiet without you are doing anything to it. So when you ask me, I sit down and there is no silence, my mind moves. I said, of course it will move. You had not noticed the movement while you were busy with your activities. Now you notice it. So notice it. The attention, the consciousness is noticing it. If you call it, if you resist it, if you fight against it, if you criticize it, then the momentum goes on increasing. Yes.
We were speaking about the silence, in silence, to sit down and be aware and observing. And what about the observing and aware in the rest of the day life?
You see, once you learn it is there, the rest of the day. Because I did not know, if the children are taught in the school how to look or how to observe, then nobody would have to sit down for half an hour or 5 minutes or 2 hours to learn it. Because we have not been educated, because we do not know, we are learning it. Once you find that the state of observation is sustained, it is there throughout the day, then you don't have to sit down. For a person, this can happen in 1 hour. If there is the intensity, it can happen in 1 hour, one sits down, learns to observe, and it's finished. If the system has not been purified before by right kind of living, by right kind of diet, if the whole body is not sensitive, if the speech is not sensitive because it has been misused, if the mind is not sensitive because it has been abused, then the time for education comes in, you see. If there is, the whole system is equipped. Supposing there is a generation that has gone through education, their children get this as inheritance, this faculty of simple attention or observation. They don't have to learn it or sit down for it and spend some time for it. And you know, when you have grown into it, when you learn to drive a car or a bicycle, or when you learn to swim, In the beginning, there is the resistance. There is the fear. There are so many inhibitions. There is the struggle. All that. But once you have learned it, then the movements are so smooth. They become extensions of your being. Whether it is a dog stroke or a frog stroke or, you know, in swimming, you go on because you know that you are there in the act of swimming. In the same way, a person who has learned to observe feels the state of observation, the steadiness of it, the simplicity of it, the chastity of that state. He feels it and he moves out of that state into relationships. So he is aware in relationship then of the objective challenge, the behavior of other people. He is aware of the subjective reactions, the mind, his own mind, that mechanistic movement. He is aware of the objective and the subjective. That is to say, the consciousness is capable of taking the objective and the subjective in one grasp, in the sweep of one grasp. Now it is a piecemeal thing. We look at something and then we react. We listen to something and then we react. We get entangled in our reactions and we lose the hold or the grip on the objective. But one who has grown in the state of observation has both the objective challenge or the situation and the subjective reaction in one grip of attention or one grip of observation.
I noticed you use one word, right living.
Yes.
What is right?
So you have come out of the hiding place. When you got a word, yes.
What is right living? If you could throw some light.
Right living is that which keeps the body, the speech, the mind. The answer was contained in my expressions. But as you have asked, I go into it. That is right diet that keeps my body supple, healthy, alert, not slow and sluggish. Not at dis-ease, but always at ease. That is right kind of speech, which exactly, precisely and accurately expresses what I imply and expresses it without hurting others, without disturbing or upsetting others. That is the right kind of use of the mind. Mind has so many faculties, it's such a complex and rich instrument developed by the human race. It's a great responsibility to use the mind. So I get acquainted with various capacities and faculties, the faculty of memory, the faculty of imagination, the faculty of receiving impression. All these faculties I get in my brain, worked upon by people through untold centuries. It's something very precious. Either I can make a prison out of it, or I can make a blessing out of it. It is with me. The me consists of it. So, the right kind of living on the mental plane would be to use the mind, to use any faculty of the mind only when the use is warranted. Now, if you have to plan for 1 week, the budget, the food, the program, the schedule, then you sit down in a group and you have to use imagination, the faculty of vision, the faculty of imagination that has to be used if you have to plan for a group, for a commune, for a village, for a city, the economic planning, the social planning. If you are working with technology, you are working with scientific research, then your memory has got to be very sharp to remember what experiments have been made before, to get acquainted with all the ingredients of the chemicals with which you are going to experiment. If the memory is weak and I don't remember what solution I have put in which bottle, and how much quantity, how many drops have to be used, how much heat has to be used, if I forget that. Slightest inaccuracy in any of my experiments in science and technology can result in a damage to millions of lives. So you need a very sharp memory if you are dealing with science and technology, engineering, and so on. So to use it at that time is warranted. But here I sit down in my room, no occupation for a couple of hours. So I go on brooding. What had happened yesterday, what happened day before, what happened last year, last month. That's a misuse of memory. That is violating the modesty of memory. Violating the modesty of imagination. We go on misusing the mind. Thinking, worrying, brooding, getting annoyed, irritated. So, when you ask me what is right kind of living, I would say a direct personal acquaintance with the physical, verbal and mental structure, discovery of their nature and their modus operandi, and an austere use of this whole mechanism with a sense of responsibility. You cannot describe right kind of living. Eat this food and you must sleep for 10 hours or 6 hours, or you must not do this and you must do this. You cannot produce definitions for other people. If I try to tell Pamela what is best for her, I am already throwing a shadow of my personal life upon her. And if you have love and respect for other human beings, how can you cast a shadow, even of your own experiences, upon other people? You can tell them, this is what has happened. But find out what kind of food, how much and when you have to eat. What kind of exercise, how much and when you have to take it. How much sleep you need. That is how you will discover. And discovering the facts of life is the essence of religion. Discovering the truth for yourself is the beauty of religion. So right kind of living is not something that you can produce a definition and say this is capable of universal application. You can only say get acquainted with what you have. Have a scientific approach, a non-emotional scientific approach that has great love and depth of care and concern behind it, so that it is used with a responsibility. Aesthetically, beautifully, scientifically, with precision, accuracy, competence and efficiency. So the body, the mind and the speech are always alert, sensitive, sharp. Whenever they have to function, they function efficiently. That for me is the right kind of living. Yes, sir.
Could you talk a little about attention?
About
attention, because when you're saying right kind of living, you're talking about being in a state of attention, aren't you?
Attention?
Yes. I mean, in the sense that sometimes if you're listening to someone talk, if you're reading a book or something like this, you can lose your attention to what is going on.
What is the question, sir? How to attend to something? Is that the question?
Not how to. Why do we lose attention?
Pardon?
Why do we lose it? Why do we...
Why do we lose...
Attention.
Attention. There can be many reasons. I can lose attention if I haven't got a very deep interest. If the question to which I am attending is not felt by me as a question of life and death, if I do not feel the urgency, if I don't feel that unless I understand this, there is a crisis in my life, if I don't see the urgency, the gravity, the depth, then my interest may flicker I go there because intellectually I see that there is no way out but this. So intellectually I move into it. But attention requires the harmony between the intellect and the feelings. It requires not an integration brought about by an effort, by a method, by a technique, but a harmonious getting together and working together of the intellect and the feelings, the nervous system and the chemical system working together in the body in harmony. If that has not been if that has not been my way of living, then I try to listen to something, because intellect says you have to listen to this. This seems to be something sane, clear. And the feeling part or the chemical part cannot keep pace with it. So it slows down and the attention flickers. So either the sense of gravity, the crisis, the urgency is not there. Supposing it is there, then it may be that the intellect and the emotions or feelings and sentiments have not been educated to grow into a harmony. As if, as it were, I am in two parts within myself. I have one, the intellectual part, and the other, the emotional. And the intellectual works, the emotional doesn't work. The emotional works, the intellectual doesn't work. It's a kind of very mild split personality in which many of us live. So the second reason, therefore, might be the emotional, the chemical, not educated to keep pace with the understanding. You will ask me, how does one do it? So before I proceed to the third factor, let me go into it. If one lives in one's daily life in such a way that one does not postpone acting upon the understanding, we understand, our understandings are not feeble. You know, human beings are not so stupid that they don't understand. But we postpone acting upon the understanding. The understanding is there, and we try to save ourselves from that understanding. We justify our weaknesses. We justify and defend our habits. And therefore, postponing the understanding, postponing the action upon the understanding, creates a time lag between the understanding part and the chemical part. One is slow and one is fast. So what does one do? One begins to live. One becomes a disciple of one's own understanding. The master, the teacher is within. No one is empty. The light of truth or reality, the light of love, the light of beauty or peace is in every human heart. So if one has the humility to become a disciple of one's own understanding, never try to compromise with the understanding, never try to defend the habits, physical or psychological, against that understanding, but let the understanding move and flow when you are in relationships, actual relationship, then this gap between the emotional and the intellectual is no more. Then they grow in harmony and they function together. On the mental intellectual plane, this division has been there because we have been fed with knowledge. Knowledge is sterile. It has no dynamism of its own. It is only organized information. So they say, well, in order to translate the knowledge into action, here are the incentives. Here are the religious incentives. Here are the ethical, moral ones. Here are the social, the economic, the political. So you have knowledge. Then gather the incentives. Use the whip of the incentives so that the knowledge gets translated into action. This has been the way of living. Therefore, man confronted with understanding finds that his emotional being doesn't cooperate. The only remedy, the only way out seems to be to live one's understanding in daily life, now and here, without compromises, without adjustments, without putting up defense. let me proceed to the third factor. The attention may not be there. We may lose attention. If we have not been careful about the body, the physical structure, if we have not fed the body properly, if we have not slept the body properly, if the body hasn't had real relaxation and the right kind of food that is agreeable to the body, then there is tension. And the tension in the stomach, the intestines, the liver, the gallbladder, the kidneys, any part, you know, it's a very sensitive part. So, tension in any of the parts of the stomach, chemical tension or neurological tension, that, how should I say, that makes the cerebral nerves weak. So when a person tries to listen to something, attend to something, one moment the attention is there, or for 10 minutes the attention is there, and then the cerebral nerves give way, and for some time they go loose, like the strings of a stringed instrument, and do what you will. You may try to force attention upon them, you may try to focus all your energy, it takes time for them to come back to that proper tension to give you the note of what you call attention. You see? So there may be this third factor of lack of sleep, or if you can manage it either ways, either you can oversleep and make the strings loose, the nerves loose, or you may not provide sleep and make them very tense. Either the nerves may be too loose, slow and sluggish, or they may be too tense. So the third factor in lack of attention could be the indifference to the physical structure. If the physical structure has been misused by indulging too much in sensual pleasure, sexual included in it, or if the physical structure has been stretched too far in the name of suppression, repression or denial, indifference or callousness to the senses, then it affects the quality of attention. It is not sustained. It is there and then it lapses into inattention. Then you bring it back and then it lapses. So the physical factor could be there also. And fourthly, this living in a distracted way may have become a pattern of ourselves, of our lives. Some people, in the name of non-conformity, in the name of no discipline, live in a very disorderly way. If the physical life is lived in a disorderly way, in a shabby way, in an unorganized way, then it affects the brain also, brain being a part of the physical. So whatever we do in a distracted way, half-heartedly, absent-mindedly, casually, then the attention also is casual. It is there or it is not there. That is why I feel, you need not agree with me, but I feel that the psychological mutation, the transformation or a religious revolution is mainly, chiefly an issue of self-education on all levels. And we have to do it by ourselves, without losing our freedom, initiative, and equipoise or balance. That is the real challenge. The challenge of a religious revolution is not something that we can go around casually. It's a very serious matter. To go through a revolution without losing my freedom, initiative and balance.
Why are we bored, and what brings about the passion for living, the passion for life? Or are you going to talk about that later, perhaps?
Why are we bored, and what brings about a passion for living, for life? I take it as a question coming from a generation, this the young generation today, not only here in this small camp. We are sitting in Sweden in a small camp, but last 6 years I have been through camps in Australia, Hong Kong, California, East Coast of USA, Holland, England, Switzerland, many places. Youth camps, youth communes. This is a question coming from a generation. And always this question brings tears of blood into my heart, because it is the elder generation that has created a world where the young, even in their teenage, feel bored with life. This is the world, and this is the structure, social, economic, political, has been created. There are many reasons for it. The rich countries and the poor countries that the young notice, because the means of transport and communications have grown so much in last 10 years or 5 years that the young go around the world. They can visit countries, various people, see them living. So they have seen, you are seeing, I'm talking to the young generation standing between the old and the young. I neither belong to the older generation nor to the young generation. I am in between. So I feel that you, the young, see what kind of world has been created. In spite of all the religions, the science, the technology, the political philosophy, the economic ideologies and theories and so on, this kind of world where wars have no end, where violence has no end, where man individually has not found peace and harmony, families have been dismembered, disintegrated, and the individual has not reclaimed himself, his freedom, his peace, his strength. So he has been uprooted from the family. In society he is nowhere, because everything in society is on such a large scale that the individual does not count at all. It's a dehumanized, depersonalized life that we live. Huge cities, monstrously huge. The other day I heard there are 4 million people in Norway, and the population of Calcutta is nearly 7 million, one city. Or population of Bombay is more than 5 million, crowded, in Tokyo, in New York, in London, all big places. So man does not count, no value. If you go to industry, the units of the plants, the units of production, they are so big that there also the individual does not matter. He has no value. He has only a number, number so and so. So dehumanized, depersonalized, collective life. There are so many intermediaries between the producer and the consumer that you have to buy things which are produced en masse, on a mass scale. Not produced for you, whether it's a shoe or whether it is a piece of cloth or shirt or a trunk or pair of trousers, you are buying things which are produced for no one. They go by numbers. So the relation between the producer consumer is not there. Production has lost the personal part of it, the affection behind it. It's on a mass scale. He goes on, a person goes on and works with one part of a one part of a one part of a machine, 6 or 7 or 8 hours. You have to see that all this leads to boredom. You come across organized religion, Hindu, Christian, Buddhist, or what you will, where those who preach religion don't live it. It has become an intellectual game, question of authority. So there too, the most tender part of yourself, the psyche, finds out that there is no correlation with people speak something and do not live it. It's a kind of disbelief, a kind of mistrust. The political leaders have added confusion. It is worst confounded confusion. So there is no aspect of life where you find that there is scope for trust, for personal warmth, for personal relationship. That is a very great factor in creating boredom. And the second is, if you have been born and brought up in an affluence-stricken countries, you have seen the intrinsic limitations of sensual pleasure. You have seen the cars, the televisions, the radios, and all the gadgets. I wouldn't even know the names of all the gadgets. The refrigerators, the cooking machines and gadgets and what you will. You have seen that you can give all the luxury to the physical body. You can keep the body in pleasure, but pleasure does not mean joy. So the youth of today is lucky. He has seen that pleasure is not joy. Comfort is not peace. Security is not happiness. So born and brought up in sensual pleasure, with no inhibitions, he has seen the limitations of sensual pleasure. Naturally he gets bored with it. He may use all the gadgets and all that, but you have a reaction against that. So you get bored. And last, I don't want to go into all the details, but this is a subject very close to my heart. We were discussing it with the young leaders of the French Revolution in 1968 summer. I was in Paris speaking at Sorbonne University when they were having the International Socialist Consolidation Movement and some revolution. In the midst of those tear gas and shells, I found myself in a youth camp. And talking to that, who is that red, something, is, I forget the name, 23-year-old chap from Germany. Yes, yes. They call him Red something. And he was discussing his plan, 14 points of the revolution program that they had, they were discussing with me. So, we won't go into the details, but the last point is, my dear Tony, the young generation has seen the electronic brain, the computer. They have seen how the computer works. They have seen the mechanistic nature of mental movement. The elderly people who have not seen it in other parts of the world, they find it very difficult even to grasp when one tries to explain to them that the cerebral functions are mechanistic. But here you have seen it. The machines can receive impressions. Even the processing of the impression is done by the machine. And it works. I wonder how many of you visited the exhibition, the Electronic Brains exhibition in London in 1969. An exhibition was held. You could go in there, you could see a computer drawing a picture, composing poems, examining papers. Many things. So the bravado that existed in the 19th century about these intellectual gymnastics, acquire an idea, organize them into theory, you become scholarly person, erudite, and people honor you. That was the 19th century. They were frightened of knowledge and scholarship and erudition. And a learned person was terribly respected. But the young man of today says, this is cerebral activity, is a mechanical activity. Even a computer does it. The processing of the data that goes on in the brain, the interpreting of it, and responding to information. So, seeing for yourself that the mental activity is a mechanistic activity. You see a spacecraft landing on the moon. You see that time is a myth. A person who goes with the spacecraft, missile, and goes around the earth 28 times in 24 hours, how do you measure his life, those who are living on the earth? Do you say that he has lived for 24 days? Because 28 days he has gone around the earth and has seen sunsets and sunrises 28 times. Now I am sitting with you, this is morning, in India it is night, and in Japan perhaps early evening or late evening. The evenings, the mornings, the time, the calculation, the measurements, they have lost their meaning, they have become irrelevant. So, a person traveling in the space, how do you measure his life? The measurement, the relativity of all measurements, all values, all symbols has become very obvious to you. So naturally, you get bored with the life of today. You feel bored with the idea of doing a job, going to an office day after day, at the same hour, working for something the results of which not related to your life or to the life of the person who makes you work. So this boredom today is the result of the total way of living that man has evolved in the East and the West. And so the young man, the young woman today asks of himself, what next? Is there anything beyond mind? Is there anything beyond brain, beyond time? If he can ask of himself this question, then he gets all the passion, all the energy. On the other hand, he says, goodness me, what a world we are born into. Look at all these elders, the leaders, what kind of education they are giving, what kind of religion they have. Then he can become a cynical person. And they can say, he can say, poor me. It's no use. Just reject everything. A blanket rejection of the total way of living, a blanket rejection of everything, and then you live in the reaction. Just rebelling against, revolting against the established patterns does not mean creating a new one. But a person who has an emotional reaction and says, goodness me, poor me, we have been born into this society, then he feels very much depressed. It has nothing to do. What is there in life? There is nothing in life. Live anyway. Live anyway. Do anything. Run away from this society. From America to India, from India to Sweden, Norway, to Holland. Run from the country, the civilization. Keep running. But you can't keep running all your life. So, the boredom and the situation that has led to boredom is a fact. Now, what do I do with myself? I am born here in a society where all this is there. Either I say, what is beyond mind, what is beyond brain, what is beyond the mechanistic activity, then there is energy, vitality, passion, then I feel, yes, here is a challenge that I take. A new exploration in the human psyche, an exploration in the inner space, or I lapse into depression, despondency, frustration, and so on, and I say, now let me just keep away from all kinds of societies, let me turn my back upon them. If I feel that whether the world improves or not, or changes or not, I don't want to live in darkness. I don't want to live in shabby depression or melancholia or depressive psychosis. Let me find out, let me discover. Not all the others are doing the same, therefore I will do. But let me find out for myself whether I can kindle a flame in my heart so that I don't have to live in darkness. Maybe when I don't live in darkness, when I discover that light, those who are around me see the light. They see the living self of a light. So, if one is not too much concerned with the world and the change in the world, but tackles the problem of the world, the global problem in himself, then there is vitality. Then there is passion.